From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax, Terminix can help. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast. If your home or business has pests, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. On the afternoon of Monday, June 13th, 1994, I was seated at my desk at ESPN. In our SportsCenter computer, I read something that made my blood run cold. It was one line in the preliminary script for the 6:30 p.m. SportsCenter, which I did not appear on. O.J. Simpson's wife and a man who had been with her had been murdered overnight our time. It had happened since I had last anchored SportsCenter the previous night, and the script for the Monday night show noted, O.J. Simpson is not a suspect. The word "not" was in capital letters. What made my blood run cold was not the news of the murders. It was that phrase. That phrase might as well have been written, of course O.J. Simpson is not a suspect. The problem was I knew Simpson was a suspect because I had not a doubt in my mind that Simpson had butchered his wife and the man Ron Goldman, because I knew what all of us who worked or had worked in Los Angeles media knew. That the O.J. Simpson known to the public of 1994, to TV audiences of 1994, to movie audiences of 1994, to sports audiences of 1994, he was an utter fabrication. He might as well have been performance art. I knew he had hit his wife repeatedly. I knew the authorities in Los Angeles had done virtually nothing about it. I knew the sportscasters in Los Angeles, including me, we had done nothing about it, though I wondered then and have come to accept since that there was almost nothing we could have done about it, not legally. But because of all that, when I read O.J. Simpson is not a suspect, I went cold, because the lie was going to continue. The cover-up of who O.J. Simpson really was going to continue, because he was going to get away with it, wasn't he? And ESPN's role in that was not intentional, any more than NBC's role had been, nor that of the producers of The Naked Gun, nor that of those of us who had been in Los Angeles media, and it didn't matter whether it was intentional or not, because you're goddamned right Simpson was a suspect. Of course he was a suspect. He was the murderer. Over the nausea, and with some concern for the reputation of ESPN in the days and weeks to come, I made a few phone calls on my own initiative to ex-media colleagues and a police source in LA, and my police source had been emphatic. Whatever you do, don't say he's a suspect. If you say that, I'll come there and I'll kill you. We are terrified he is going to run. This guy has "Make for the Border" written all over him. Or off himself, maybe. But yeah, maybe, and he had had to stop himself from laughing at this point, maybe you want to drop that part about not a suspect. Jesus Christ, not a suspect. He's our only suspect. I can still feel what it felt like to put the phone back in the cradle, and I remember getting up from my desk to go slowly walk over to talk to the news editors, to go tell people, some of whom were still saying out loud, "Poor OJ," to tell them that all they thought they knew about OJ Simpson was a lie, and to tell them that I was one of the hundreds of people who had inadvertently helped to protect that lie, who had, to that point, helped him get away with it. And to tell them that they had better edit that script, because I had just been told, not a suspect, he's our only suspect. I convinced them. SportsCenter just dropped the line. It did not report that he was not a suspect. But to be fair, the news editors and some of the on-air people and a couple of the executives spent that week, until he made a run for it, convinced that I was nuts. And that when they found whoever had done this awful thing to OJ's wife, and of course to OJ, ESPN was going to look ridiculous. And then he made the run for it. And even after that, there were people at NBC, when I first worked there in 1997, who had come finally to accept the fact that he had done it, but who could never quite shake the belief that maybe there was some other explanation that hadn't come to light yet, because that wasn't the OJ they knew. And that was the catch. OJ Simpson was a better actor than anybody will ever realize. This creature was as popular and as well known in three different fields in this country simultaneously as almost anybody else who is in only one of those fields. And then he murdered two people brutally, hands-on, face-to-face, and got away with it, and then somehow managed to do something in some contexts even worse. I don't like to joke about death, even the death of O.J. goddamned Simpson. But the something worse was summarized in a joke by the Toronto Star columnist Bruce Arthur, after Simpson's death yesterday. "Right now," Bruce Arthur tweeted, "Cancer is writing a book called If I Did It." Even at the time, I don't think the audacity, the indescribable gall for a man to get away with murder and then try to write a book, nominally a novel, in which he speculated about how he had committed the murder he'd just been acquitted of, how he had killed his wife and Ron Goldman, how he would have done it if he had killed her. He really wrote it, or a ghostwriter wrote it for him and with him. He really tried to work both the angles. Commit the crime, get acquitted, write a book, make some money. It's one of the most deeply morally bankrupt things I have ever heard of anybody doing, short of serial killing. Since the news of O.J. Simpson's death, I've been thinking a lot about him and who he really was and what we knew about him in the years I worked in local news in Los Angeles from 1985 till the very end of 1991, and the immutable fact that if you did not know the public O.J. Simpson, who killed his ex-wife and Ronald Goldman in 1991, I can never describe just how popular he was. Maybe I can just give you a glimpse in the sad and in many quarters still startled commemorations of the various anniversaries of the white Bronco car chase the beginning of the O.J. Simpson most people today think of, the birth of the monster. There seemed to be only passing reference to one of the most amazing transformations in American history, let alone American sports history or American entertainment history. On June 17, 1994, when the Los Angeles Police Department, including my friend, whose premonitions that Simpson would bolt proved all too accurate, when the LAPD finally that day admitted that O.J. Simpson was a suspect in the murder of his ex-wife and Ronald Goldman, and then they said, oh, he's going to be turning himself in, and then came back and said, well, no, he has not shown up, and he is, in fact, now a fugitive from justice. And then his attorney implied that O.J. Simpson had not turned himself in and had fled so he could go kill himself. And then the car chase played out in front of 95 million TV witnesses. And all this happened in one day. One of the most popular people in American history instantly became its greatest living villain. There is no hypothetical comparison in the America of today. With the internet, with the paparazzi, with the maxed out cynicism about sports and TV and celebrity, there is nobody who was as Teflon as the O.J. Simpson of pre-June 1994. I mean, not even Trump. Trump had fans, but nobody ever liked Trump. And Trump was never for a second one of the top 100,000 most popular people in the country, let alone top 10. Like O.J. Simpson was, maybe top five. There is a touch of the Simpson story in the story of Trump. That Freudian slip in the Los Angeles Times obit yesterday wasn't really that funny, was it? Writing Trump had gotten out of prison when it was supposed to read Simpson had gotten out of prison. Too close to home, as they say. Maybe. And I apologize to her in advance for even dragging her name into this, in this craziest of hypotheticals. Maybe it would be as if Taylor Swift became a murder suspect today and fled, and the police chase was being shown live on every television channel. Out of nowhere. Seemingly. But that absurd hypothetical is not even good enough. Simpson was not just a star entertainer. Not just a star athlete, virtually uncriticized, instantly recognizable nationwide. He had become one of the most prominent sportscasters and one of the most prominent actors and one of the most prominent advertising spokesmen. O.J. Simpson, the football player, was one thing. O.J. Simpson was also O.J. Simpson, the rental car pitchman. Go, O.J., go. O.J. Simpson was also O.J. Simpson from NBC Sports. O.J. Simpson was also O.J. Simpson as Nordberg in the Naked Gun movies. O.J. Simpson was just O.J. So popular, so ubiquitous that he was known by two letters. And O.J. Simpson was about getting away with it. Because he was also O.J. Simpson, the wife batterer. But he lived in the era, at the end of the era, where the public persona was not only all that people knew about him, it was all that people wanted to know about him. In 1994, we thought we were living in the middle of the tabloid era. In fact, we were just 9 years removed from actor Rock Hudson shocking untold Americans when he died of AIDS, because for 30 years he had been the heartthrob of millions of women, a staggering percentage of whom, on the day he died, had no earthly clue that he had been gay. I loathe the tabloid era and lament what it has done to American sports, to American entertainment, to America. But there is one thing to be said for today's America, where a has-been ex-Fox Newsie with an unlistened-to podcast could berate the cover art on the new Beyoncé album, and within an hour there's a story on it in the New York Post. And O.J. Simpson in 2024 would not have been able to hide his true self for a month. Whatever the full stories are, whatever miscarriages of justice there may be in either direction, you know about Kanye West and Johnny Depp and Sean Diddy Combs and you would have known about O.J. Simpson. Early on New Year's morning, January 1st, 1989, police went to the infamous home on North Rockingham in Brentwood and arrested O.J. Simpson on spousal battery charges. He had punched and kicked his wife. She said he had screamed, "I'll kill you." He had slapped her so hard that his handprint was still visible on her neck when police arrived and took him away and took her to the hospital. And O.J. Simpson's reaction on New Year's Day, officers on the scene quoted him in their official report as saying, "The police have been out here 8 times before, and now you're going to arrest me for this? This is a family matter. Why do you want to make a big deal out of it when we can handle it?" Today, that mindless, murderous statement would have been videotaped or leaked, or in some way, it would have made its way around the world fast enough that it would have been on Twitter X within minutes. But then, in 1989, in Los Angeles media, we didn't know about the assault until months later when O.J. Simpson pleaded out the charges. We certainly didn't know about the 9 police trips to what would become the murder scene on North Rockingham. But we did know who O.J. Simpson was. We had heard the stories hidden behind the big smile, that he hit women, that police had been to his house, that while married, whenever he spoke to a group of students, he would bring his creepy friend Al Cowlings with him, and he'd have Cowlings approach the girls that he, O.J., was interested in to provide himself deniability. One of my producers said he'd seen Simpson and Cowlings do that at a lecture at USC. Another friend said he'd been producing an ESPN show with Simpson at a charity golf tournament somewhere. And during the commercial breaks, Simpson stood up and asked the producer how long the break was. And he and Cowlings went onto the golf course to go look for women during the 2 minutes and 30 seconds. We knew. And between the laws and customs that still protected the man in domestic cases 95% of the way, and the laws and customs of a one-industry town like Los Angeles that still protected the celebrity 95% of the way, we could say nothing about his character. In a way, we still can't. I mean, read the obituaries. Cleared of murder charges. Found not guilty. Murder trial was a sensation. Even the Onion joke about the coffin not fitting, so OJ's not really dead. We still can't say it. He's dead now, and it is times like these that I hope that there really is a hell. But for all the existence we can confirm, all the punishments we can comprehend, the bastard is still getting away with it, isn't he? As I sat down to record this, O.J. Simpson was beginning to sink, in the sports headlines at least, below that of the Shohei Ohtani-related gambling story, which I will present shortly in full, but the headline of which is, his interpreter allegedly stole enough money and confessed to stealing enough money from Ohtani that his total of winning and losing bets on sporting events over 3 years was $325 million. Simpson, not a victim, and Ohtani, definitely a victim, had the field to themselves news-wise because this is the state of American governance, thanks to the Republican Party. It has introduced 6 bills into the House of Representatives for debate and deliberation next week. H.R. 6192, the Hands Off Our Home Appliances Act. H.R. 7673, the Liberty and Laundry Act. H.R. 7645, the Clothes Dryers Reliability Act. H.R. 7637, the Refrigerator Freedom Act. H.R. 7626, the Affordable Air Conditioning Act. And H.R. 7700, the Stop Unaffordable Dishwasher Standards Act. Your tax dollars in action. What I truly do not understand here is how, the vital components contained in the Liberty and Laundry Act and the Affordable Air Conditioning Act are not already covered by the Hands Off Our Home Appliances Act. If the Republicans in the House, under the leadership of Speaker Mike Johnson, actually pass any of this stuff in the face of climate disaster, I just have this mental picture of some future set of Republican leaders being swept away when a tidal wave and a hurricane hit Washington, D.C. simultaneously, and them screaming, "Forgive us and we repent," like Zod and the other insurrectionists do just before they're sucked up into the Phantom Zone mirror prison device in the first Superman movie. And yes, I had to Google all the names and terms. But don't worry, Republicans. None of that will happen with climate disaster for another 18 months at least. Turns out the King Zod of the Republicans is meeting with Mike Refrigerator Freedom Act Johnson today for a joint news conference at Mar-a-Lago about election integrity at Johnson's suggestion. As one would suggest co-hosting a Bullies Are Great news conference to your school bully. It's easy to propose such a thing, since all you and Trump have to do is decide which lies to stick to. The idea that Johnson is being made to kiss the ring here seems to be something of an exaggeration. Politico and a couple of other news orgs quoted a lot of Trump people yesterday as saying they have no interest in seeing another new Speaker of the House. They don't want the distraction. It would be a distraction from Trump holding center stage 24/7 until the election and twirling that big arrow sign he has with "Look at me" written on it. Also, turns out that when Trump insisted Republicans kill the new FISA Act because he thinks it was used against him, he didn't know that was a different part of FISA legislation, because why would he know that? His brain does not function like a human's. Among humans and human adults in politics, the president late yesterday did have the DOJ finalize the regulation change at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that redefines 23,000 vendors in this country who sell guns not in gun stores but at gun shows as gun dealers, effectively closing the gun show loophole that has allowed tens of thousands of guns a year to be sold without licenses or background checks or much of anything. The NRA will challenge in court, which is a neat trick, considering it supposedly had filed for bankruptcy. Speaking of bankrupt, there's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He has finally gotten around to firing his New York campaign director, the one who said the quiet part out loud about how getting Trump elected, not him elected, was her number one priority. Among other things, the campaign says that when this Rita Palma identified herself as his New York campaign director, she wasn't. She was just a staffer. Still with the New York campaign, per the investigative reporter Jacqueline Sweet, is Jillian Byrne, co-host of an upcoming Kennedy fundraiser on Long Island this month, who seemed to also reveal that the whole point of the Kennedy campaign is, as the rest of us already know, to get Trump elected. There hasn't been a path to victory for Republicans in New York State since Reagan in 80 and 84, she tweeted Monday of this week. RFK Jr. is coming for New York State's 28 electoral votes. And the moron misspelled Reagan. Also, after months of this stuff that would make his father or any of his uncles hit Bob Jr. in the head with a baseball bat, it has finally dawned on me that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. looks exactly as if he is a character being played by an aged by makeup Fred Armisen, formerly of Saturday Night Live. Also of interest here, the Otani story. His interpreter was a kind of genius until he got caught. But he not only stole millions from the baseball star, but he turned the process that allowed him to do that into a kind of secret machine that enabled him to average one $17,000 or so bet on one sporting event every hour for 3 years. And just to prove there's nothing new under the sun on this all-new edition of the podcast, this week's Thurber story about how from 1935 to 1941, the founder of the New Yorker magazine had $1.5 million stolen from him by his assistant, because his assistant needed all the money so he could spend all the money gambling on sporting events. That's next. This is Countdown.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
This is Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
This is SportsCenter. Wait, check that. Not anymore. This is Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
Still ahead on this all-new edition of Countdown, Fridays with Thurber and a story he wrote in the 1940s that seems literally ripped from today's headlines because it's about a trusted assistant and employee of a famous rich person embezzling money. A lot of money, the equivalent of $1.5 million, and the celebrity never knew about it until it was too late because in sports, Dateline, someplace where I can't believe I'm actually reading these numbers, even though I'm reading these numbers for like the 17th time, California. Okay, so my money managers demand that I give them receipts for like everything more than $500. And once they asked for one, for a receipt, for something I bought on eBay for $220. And somehow, the folks who handle Shohei Ohtani were unable to find out that his interpreter had stolen $16 million from him. Ipe Mizuhara somehow sneaked an entire structure past Ohtani, past Ohtani's agents, past Ohtani's bankers, past Ohtani's tax experts in two different countries, all of it apparently predicated on the idea that none of them spoke Japanese, and none of them were permitted to talk to Ohtani himself. They had to go through the interpreter, who convinced the bank that he was Ohtani, who convinced the agents that Ohtani did not want them to have access to nor knowledge of this one bank account. Who convinced the bookie that Ohtani was knowingly covering the translator's debts. Less than a month ago, March 20th, Ipe Mizuhara texted the bookie about the first media attention to his crimes. "Have you seen the reports?" he asked. The bookie wrote back, "Obviously you didn't steal from him. Well, I understand it's a cover job. I totally get it." Mizuhara replied, "Technically I did steal from him. It's all over for me." Lots of people have stolen lots of money by abusing the trust of friends, spouses, relatives, employees, employers, any combination you can think of. As I mentioned, this week's Thurber story coming up is The Secret Life of Harold Wini. And he was the assistant to the founder of the New Yorker magazine, Harold Ross, who hated financial details. And so he had this Wini guy handle them for him. And before he knew what happened, Wini had stolen $70,000 in 1940 money, the equivalent of about $1.5 million today from Harold Ross. But that was $1.5 million. This was $16 million in 3 years. And the $16 million stolen is, figuratively speaking, the smallest number in the bunch. And that's what is staggering about the Shohei Ohtani story. For 3 years, Ipe Mizuhara placed approximately 25 bets on sporting events per day for a total of 19,000 bets. The money he won added to the money he lost totaled $325 million. And he lost $40 million more than he won. He won $142 million gambling on sports in 3 years. He lost $183 million. That does not mean he bet $325 million. Most gambling addicts are just taking their winnings and rolling them over into new bets. Still, this meant that those 25 sports bets a day had an effective value of $17,000 each. Mizuhara could go to jail for 30 years. He is apparently cooperating and trying to make a plea deal. Ohtani is the victim of the crime here. And for if I did infer that there was something wrong here and imply that to you, I apologize to Ohtani, but he's also the victim of some really, really lax financial self-protection. They say he has cooperated fully too. Better late than never on this, giving his devices over so that people can find out what really happened. And if you needed a laugh line to help you put your jaw back on, $325 million wagered, effectively. Authorities say Mizuhara also managed to spend $325,000 on sports memorabilia, most of it on eBay. They say they found 1,000 baseball cards in his car. Well, I'm not casting any stones on this part of it. Indiana Fever, it was announced yesterday, will play 40 games in the 2024 season. 35 of those 40 games will be televised or streamed nationally. Some on ESPN, CBS, ABC, Prime Video. Who the hell are the Indiana Fever? The Indiana Fever are, or is, the worst team in the WNBA. Well, let me say that correctly. WNBA. The 13 games they won last year were as many as the franchise had won in a single season since 2016. In four of the last seven seasons, they have won either five or six games for the whole year. So why would all but five of their games be nationally broadcast next year? Because the Indiana Fever holds the number one pick in the WNBA draft next Monday. And the number one pick in the WNBA draft next Monday is going to be Caitlin Clark from Iowa. Her team did not win the Women's Collegiate Basketball Championship last weekend, but she is still the centerpiece in a new era of women's sports in this country. The Men's College Basketball Championship game Monday night drew a television audience of 14,820,000 viewers. It was shown on the TBS, TNT, and True TV networks. The Women's College Basketball Championship game Sunday afternoon drew 18,870,000 viewers on ABC
and ESPN, that would be 4,050,000 more than the men got. Obviously, it is a gender-first, an extraordinary milestone. I am confident, however, in my credentials in this area to point out one caveat. My credentials first. On Martin Luther King Day in 1995, January 16th, we were sitting in the conference room at ESPN, the conference room, we only had the one, debating what to lead with on that night's 11 p.m. SportsCenter. The NBA schedule was pretty much mismatches. Looking back on it now, you'll see the L.A. Lakers were playing the L.A. Clippers that day. That could have been good. Nah, the Lakers were 21-11. The Clippers were 5-30. The NHL games were meh. The non-game sports news was not that interesting. So I pointed up at a monitor of what was being shown on our network that holiday afternoon. Our network, we only had the one. And I said, why not lead with that? Lead with that game between the number one college basketball team in the country, since they're 16-0 and unbeaten, and they're playing the number two college basketball team in the country, since they're 12-0, and it is on our air, and the number two team is winning. It's going to be an upset, a signal moment in the sport. And somebody at the table said, lead with women's basketball? And I said, I don't care who's playing. It's undefeated. Top two teams facing each other, and number two is winning. We led SportsCenter with that game that night. UConn beating Tennessee on the way to UConn's undefeated national championship season. We did not change the history of women's college basketball. I did not change their history. But making them the lead on SportsCenter that night polished the credentials just a little bit. So my caveat comes from that point of view, that pro women's basketball point of view that is now 29 years old. That the two ratings from TV broadcasts of the championship games are close is a phenomenal achievement. Finally, it's happened. But the women's game was on a broadcast network, ABC, and the men's was only on cable. And the women's game was on Sunday afternoon when kids could watch, and the men's game was at 9:20 Eastern time at night when they couldn't. But I guess the ultimate point here isn't whether or not the comparison between the ratings of the men's and women's championships games is fair or has to be. Caveat, the point is, we now have to find caveats and reasons and excuses to make the men's second place TV ratings look a little bit better when we compare them to the women's. Congratulations, women. Thank you, Nancy Faust. Dateline, an MRI machine near you. If you are wondering if it's just your imagination or if more baseball pitchers than ever before are getting injured and having career-threatening surgery early in the 2024 Major League Baseball season, no, actually it is your imagination. While the percentage of big-name pitchers who face Tommy John surgery on the elbow may be way up, Spencer Strider of the Braves, Eury Pérez of Miami, Josiah Gray of Washington. Travis Sochik of the website The Score says the numbers don't lie. Through the first 100 days of the year, there have been 9 major league pitchers who are getting or gotten Tommy John surgery. That's a lot. It's a lot more than last year's total of 2 in the first 100 calendar days of 2023. But in the preceding 10 years, there had been 9 or more Tommy John surgeries in 3 different years. 9 is a lot, but it's not the most. It's tied for second. More importantly, the total number in all of professional baseball this year is 16 surgeries. By this date in 2018, there had been 40 of these surgeries. By this date in 2021, there had been 47 of them. The number is actually way down overall throughout baseball. But as to why these surgeries are happening, the Players Association has recently posited it might be because of the pitch clock. There's no evidence that's the cause. The explanation is, in fact, what it always has been. Facing fastballs measuring between 90 and 93 miles an hour, big league hitters batted 275 last year. Facing fastballs measured at 96 miles an hour or faster, they hit 234 last year. Pitchers are throwing harder, more often, and doing it younger, and the human arm is not built for what they're trying to do. One thing is definitely not true. Some old-time pitchers will still insist today's pitchers are being babied. In fact, they are not throwing enough. I once had this conversation with the Hall of Famer Tom Seaver of the New York Mets, who pointed out that only once in his first 12 seasons did he not pitch at least 250 innings in each season, and he lasted until he was 41 before he had a significant injury. And my answer to him was, how did it all turn out for Gary Gentry? Referring to his Met teammate whose pitching career essentially ended when he was 26. Gary Gentry, who probably needed Tommy John surgery. Sorry, there isn't Tommy John surgery yet. And then I added, and how did it turn out for Les Rohr and Dennis Musgraves, Brent Strom, Dick Rustek, Al Schmelz, Jerry Hinsley, Bill Dennehy, Rob Gardner, Tommy Moore, every other Met pitcher who got injured who I can't name off the top of my head. Pitchers used to get just as injured, or nearly so, as they do now. You just didn't hear about it because the surgery to resuscitate their careers did not exist yet. And also, cruelly, they were paid so little in those days that it was easier for teams to just drop them when they got hurt rather than spend the money to try to repair them.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50. And it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
Fridays with Thurber now, and from his book, The Years with Ross, which is a now criticized recollection of the founding of the New Yorker magazine by its original creator, Harold Ross, with the help of James Thurber at every turn for the first 40 years of the magazine's history. As I said, it has been criticized in many respects as being a little tough on Mr. Ross. On the other hand, I have yet to read any criticism of the story that Thurber tells, except perhaps that maybe he should have been a little bit more blunt about what he's talking about here, but it was written in the late 1940s and early 1950s. One part of this subject was not discussed in public and certainly not in print. But the rest of it will sound probably fairly familiar to you, even though you've never heard about the man or the man he did this to. But what he did was timeless. Only the names and the cities and the actual amounts vary from century to century. From The Years with Ross, The Secret Life of Harold Winnie by James Thurber. Harold Winnie, who seemed to me, and still does, as unreal as the look and sound of his name, was Harold Ross's private secretary from 1935 until the middle of August 1941. In his years with Ross, the pallid, silent young man steadily swindled the editor out of a total of $71,000. Reader's note, that is the equivalent in 2024 terms of $1.5 million. His multiple forgeries, his raids and inroads upon Ross's bank account, expense account, salary, and securities belong in St. Clair McKelway's Of Crime and Rascality, somewhere between the magnificently complicated defalcations of the Wiley Wilby and the fantastic dollar bill counterfeiting of old 880. Bankers, taxmen, and accountants still shake their heads in wonder and disbelief over the case history of Harold Winnie, which has become a part of the folklore and curiosa of American capitalism. Nobody at the New Yorker offices knew or cared very much about Harold Winnie, who had been born about 1910 in or near Albany, New York, the only child of a man who died when his son was very young, and of a mother who fortunately did not live long enough to know about her son's crimes. I remember Winnie mainly for his cold, small voice, his pale, nimble fingers, and his way of moving about the corridors and offices like a shadow. I do not believe that Harold Ross ever looked at the man closely enough to have been able to describe him accurately. He was what Ross once irritably described as a worm. That is, an unimportant cog in the New Yorker wheel, a non-creative person. As a secretary, Winnie was competent and quiet. He took dictation speedily and transcribed his notes the same way. I would be sitting in my office and suddenly his voice would surprise me, for I never heard him enter the room. "Mr. Ross would like your opinion on this," he would say, and hand me a typewritten query about something or other. This was in the days when I could still see to read. He would stand there absolutely motionless, without a word, and wait for me to tell him what I thought, or to type my reply on a piece of paper. Then he would silently vanish. He was a master of the art of protective immobility. I remember that he was neat to the point of being immaculate, but the clothes he wore were as unobtrusive as his manner. When investigators examined his apartment, they found, among other things, 103 suits of clothes, which he had bought with the money stolen from Ross. They also found, in a private correspondence file, a long exchange of letters with a real estate firm in Tahiti. Winnie had planned, a little vaguely, to flee when he had piled up enough of his employer's money, but the embezzler never does get enough, and when, in the summer of 1941, his crimes were discovered, the war was on, and he could not obtain a passport. Discovery, in the end, was inevitable. The miracle is that it didn't come some years sooner. If Winnie drank or smoked, it was usually in moderation. And there was only one subject in the world that could light up his cold eyes and his impassive face. That was horse racing. He was a horse player, completely addicted to it, and a steady loser. nobody will ever know how much he lost in gambling on the horses or what exactly became of the $71,000 he stole. Copies of his private letters to men friends revealed that he spent his money lavishly upon some of them, buying one an expensive sports car, outfitting another with complete skiing equipment, and giving them money for their vacations and holidays. Investigators were baffled at every turn in trying to trace what happened to Ross's money. There was, however, a record of a big champagne party Winnie gave in a suite at the Astor Hotel on the night in November 1940 when Roosevelt was elected president for the third time. "I walked past the Astor several times that night with friends," Ross told me gloomily, "and I guess I was hit on the head by my own champagne corks." He gestured toward the room just outside his own office where Winnie had had his desk and typewriter. "He sat out there and fed me cake," Ross moaned. Winnie was, by a familiar caprice of nature, incapable of emotional interest in females, and this was as apparent to all of us, except Ross, as the simple fact that Mary Pickford is a woman. To Ross, however, who never scrutinized his secretary or gave him any real thought, he was nothing more than a chair in his office or the ashtray on his desk. "Did you know he was that kind of a man?" Ross asked me and the rest of us, and we all just stared at him and said, "Yes, didn't you?" Ross would brush this aside and say, "Ah, then it explains the whole business. That kind of guy always wants to ruin the normal man." Ross was by no means, of course, financially ruined by Winnie, for he still had plenty of money of his own after the loss of the $71,000. During the almost 7 years that Winnie robbed Ross day after day, the editor was at the peak of his work and his worries in every field. In 1935, the year Winnie came to work for him, Ross's daughter was born, and the magazine was developing rapidly in every way. In the midst of all this, Ross recognized the necessity of, quote, delegating, unquote, some of his duties and some of his worries. He made the mistake of delegating to Harold Winnie complete control without any safeguard whatever of his bank accounts and securities. He had two separate accounts in one bank. The bank tellers and vice presidents became familiar with the quiet, well-behaved, efficient young man who was Ross's private secretary and whom, the editor had made it clear, he reposed every trust. Thus, when Winnie showed up at a teller's cage with a check made out to cash signed with the unmistakable signature of H.W. Ross, the check was not subjected to more than casual scrutiny. Even if it had been, Winnie's forgery of Ross's name was so perfect that after the secretary's death, the few canceled checks that could be found baffled not only handwriting experts, but even Ross himself, who could not swear whether a given signature was his own or Winnie's. Winnie's own initials were H.W. And all he had to imitate were the six letters of H.W. Ross. He became an expert at it. As the years went on, he grew bolder and bolder, and in 1 week, the record shows, cashed three separate checks for a total of $6,000. At that period, Ross's main financial interest was in his friend Dave Chasen's restaurant in Hollywood. About the time that Harold Winnie began robbing Ross, the restaurant began to make money. Ross had originally lent Chasen $3,000, a generous personal loan of the kind for which he was well known to his intimates. Sums of money like that did not bother Ross when it came to helping out one of the men to whom he was most devoted. Later, he began investing in the restaurant. Then his profits increased, but he could never quite accommodate himself to the idea that he deserved the profits, which amounted finally to more than $200,000. "God damn it, I never intended to make a lot of money out of Dave's place," he once told a lawyer. "Hard for me to think he owes me anything except on the basis of personal loans." The difference between a loan and an investment had to be explained to him patiently. I know all that," he would say, putting on his well-known expression of worry and wonder. Winnie began cautiously by forging six checks in 1935 for a total of about $1,400. The next year, he forged 7 checks for a total of $1,900. In 1937, there were 9 checks, and the amount was $2,900. And in 1938, the year before he threw caution to the winds, he forged 7 checks for $2,730. During all this time, he was careful to fill out checkbook stubs and reconcile them precisely with Ross's monthly bank statements. He had soon discovered, but probably couldn't believe it, that Ross did not want to be bothered by studying his checkbooks or monthly statements. So Winnie summarized them, as he explained it to Ross, and would simply lay a typed sheet of paper on Ross's desk when he was asked about the state of his account. If Ross spotted some familiar amount, such as $113.13, and said, "I thought that check went through last month," Winnie would simply tell him quietly that he was wrong. The cake became easier and easier to feed to Ross, and Winnie finally abandoned entirely the unnecessary work of justification. He would simply tear a check out of a checkbook, fill it out for whatever amount he wanted, sign Ross's name, and cash it at the bank. When he really began to splurge with Ross's money and visit the bank several times a week, he would hand in the check and wink slyly at the teller as if to say, "The old boy's at it again." I don't know how many persons outside the New Yorker and Ross's circle of friends knew how often Ross gambled and how often he lost, but it was scarcely a state secret. Dozens of checks for gambling losses, averaging around $500, were duplicated by Winnie before he sent them, with Ross's genuine signature on them, to the lucky winners. During 1939 and 1940 and up until the end of July 1941, Winnie forged 160 checks for a total of about $62,000. By the end of July 1941, he had withdrawn all of his employer's salary through December, and along with it, several thousand dollars of Ross's expense account money. Winnie was a well-implemented student of his employer. He was, however, at all times skating on ice that grew thinner and thinner, and he must have known that sooner or later it would break under him. It may be that he hoped to restore the money he had taken if he could only win a large amount on the horses or make some quick and profitable investment, but nobody knows about that, or if anybody does, nothing has ever been revealed. Winnie's friends, or such of them as were found and talked to, claimed they knew nothing about his secret life. This may well have been true. He was as tight-mouthed as he was thin-lipped. The withdrawal in advance of Ross's salary and expense account money had to be accomplished through the New Yorker's own business department, and in spite of the tension between the editor and that department, it remained something of a miracle that nothing was said to Ross about this thing until the middle of August 1941. One man in the business department, who has been there for more than 30 years, told me what I already knew, that if the business department ever mentioned money to Ross, he yelled them down, or said they were crazy, or announced that he didn't want to talk about it, and hung up the phone. There were years during which he would refuse to discuss anything at all with his partner, Raoul Fleischman, and such communications as passed between them were carried on circuitously. Winnie was also a close student of this situation. In 1938, Ross and his second wife spent several months in France and England, and before he left, he put his securities in Winnie's hands, giving him power of attorney over them. In order to replenish this or that account in a crisis, the secretary would sell some of Ross's securities. Ross both played into Winnie's hands and made things a bit difficult for him by carrying loose checks in his pocket and making them out to this person or that, or to this firm or that, sometimes remembering to tell Winnie about them the next day, but often forgetting it. In this way, Winnie could never be sure what situation would confront him at the end of any given month. During the last year of Winnie's peculations, he caused Ross to be overdrawn multiple times at the bank. When this situation occurred, Winnie would either transfer some funds from the account in Jane Grant's name, his wife, Ross's wife, to Ross's own account, or cover up by selling some more of Ross's securities. The mad, intelligent Ross, as Janet Flanner once called him, had simply forgotten to cancel Winnie's power of attorney after the editor got back from France. Ross expected to get loyalty from those around him the way he expected to get his mail. But he didn't get that always either. All communications from the bank and several letters from a firm of tax experts suggesting that they supervise Ross's financial interests were simply torn up and thrown away by Ross's secretary. When it comes to money, bank accounts, and everything else, fiscal or financial, I am not one to throw stones, but a pot as black as the kettle. I once had a checking account in a famous old Fifth Avenue bank through the recommendation of Ralph Ingersoll, but after I had been overdrawn three times, I was invited to talk it over with a vice president of the bank. He was shocked, almost beyond words, when he discovered that I did not fill out my checkbook stubs. "Then how do you know how much money you have in the bank?" he asked me, and I told him I estimated. He turned a little white, and his hand trembled. "You estimate it?" he croaked. That bank was glad to get rid of me. I have always had the good sense to let my wife handle my finances, but Ross would have just goggled at anyone who suggested that he put such a responsibility upon his own spouse. It was not only his strangeness about dough, but his erratic judgments of men that put such a powerful temptation in the way of Harold Winnie. One of those around him in the early years, a man he both liked and trusted, and rightly so, was Ralph Paladino. When he was young and single, Ralph took a course in public accounting at a night school, and Ross attended his graduation exercises. Ralph, it seemed to us in those days, kept track of everything for Ross. He was an expert on order, organization, dough, records, and everything else that Ross worried about. Then Ralph was married, and after a while had children, and needed an increase of salary, and Ross would not okay this. I still get mad at him when I think about it, and I once bawled him out for it after Ralph quit and took a better-paying job. "I haven't got time for little people," Ross snarled, and I told him that was a hell of a thing to say. He later apologized for it, murmured something about all the physical troubles that he had at the time, a jaw infection, his ulcers, and the spreading of the metatarsal bones of one foot. Ralph Paladino, by the way, is now head of the makeup department at Newsweek. Last year, a man who works over there told me he is our one most indispensable man. Harold Ross had a lot of things to think about in 1941, including his approaching third marriage, three of my five eye operations, the war and all that did to him, and 100 other concerns. He himself had withdrawn some of his salary and expense account that year, and this gave Winnie the idea of withdrawing the rest of it. Such transactions as this had to be okayed by the Miracle Man. During most of this period, it was Ick Schumann, the Miracle Man being Thurber's term for Ross's term for editor-in-chief of the magazine. One day after Winnie had withdrawn Ross's salary and expense money for October, November, and December, Raoul Fleischman sent for Schumann and said, "Did you know that Ross is hard up?" They discussed the matter, and Ick said he would look into it. For a while, Ross simply did not believe or even listen to what Schumann had to tell him about his withdrawn salary. Then he sent for Winnie. That doomed young man knew that he had come to the end of the line, but he didn't turn white or begin shaking, or break down and confess. He simply double-talked Ross into deeper and deeper confusion until the editor said, "Ah, the hell with it. I'll stop in at the bank tomorrow and find out all about it myself." That sentence was Harold Winnie's death sentence. After work, he went home to his expensive and tidily furnished apartment in Brooklyn, turned on the gas in the kitchen, and took his own life. When the body of Harold Winnie was discovered the next day in his Brooklyn apartment, Ross was greatly upset, and when the first batch of his manifold forgeries came to light, he expressed pity for him and even compassion. According to Schumann and Jim Kincaid, Ross's great gumshoe, Kincaid had been assigned to find out as much as he could about what Winnie had done to Ross, and when the staggering total of the quiet young man's thefts became clear, Ross no longer said, as he had been saying, "The poor little guy." What mainly bothered Ross, however, was not the amount of his losses, but the feeling that his friends at the 21 Club, as Schumann put it, would never get over kidding him about it all. So the actual total of the forgeries was not given out to the papers. They were told that it was somewhere between $17,000 and $20,000. That's what Ross told me, too. I think that he was wrong about this. Any American can be taken for $17,000 or $20,000, but it takes a really great eccentric to be robbed of $71,000 right under his own busy nose. I am told that Ross could not be reimbursed by the bank for his losses because he had made this legally impossible by the way he ignored his monthly statements, and by his having given power of attorney to Winnie, which he never withdrew. It seems that Ross did get $5,000 of Harold Winnie's insurance money. What I remember mainly about the wreckage of that tragic August was a strange threat Ross made. He was going to get even with the bank, he said, by hiring Steve Hannigan. Just what he expected, that late famous public relations man, sometimes known as the discoverer of Florida, to do, I have no way of knowing. Ross soon realized, of course, that publicity was precisely what he did not want. Among those to whom Ross occasionally lost money at backgammon or gin rummy was a well-known New York publisher, and whenever he won from $200 to $500 from Ross, Winnie would duplicate the check so that Ross really always lost twice as much as he believed he had. Losing anything to a publisher was, to H.W. Ross, something that there could be nothing more deplorable than. He fought publishers on behalf of writers all his life and wrote literally hundreds of letters bawling them out. One of these, to Marshall Best, runs to 2,000 words. In a letter to Ross, the publisher had accused him of obscurantism, and Ross ended his reply, "Wee, let's have oceans of obscurantism." Ross and the New Yorker never took any subsidiary rights at all from writers and artists, but were satisfied with first serial rights. When Ross found out that publishers often got a percentage of their authors' sales of movie or theater rights, he banged away at them with his trusty typewriter, and you could hear it all the way down the hall. He also fought them for better royalties for writers and for a more equitable arrangement on anthologies. He once got a letter from Christopher Lafarge, then president of the Authors League, thanking him on behalf of the authors of the country for what he had been doing and was still doing. I don't know how to end this count of the short, unhappy life of Harold Winnie, but I guess I'll just put down what two different admirers of Ross, who did not know the Winnie story, said in the same voice after I had told them the tale. "What a wonderful man," said one of them. "What a crazy guy," said the other. The Secret Life of Harold Winnie. Sounds vaguely familiar. Gambling on horses. Gambling on sports. Assistant. Translator. 20th century. 21st century. If there's a 22nd century, there'll be a translator or an assistant doing the same thing to somebody else. I've done all the damage I can do here for yet another week. Thank you for listening. Countdown musical directors Brian Ray and John Philip Chenail arranged, produced, and performed most of our music. Mr. Ray was on guitars, bass, and drums, and Mr. Chenail handled orchestration and keyboards, produced by TKO Brothers. Other music, including some of the Beethoven compositions, were arranged and performed by the group No Horns Allowed. The sports music is the Olbermann theme from ESPN2, written by Mitch Warren Davis, courtesy of ESPN Inc. Our satirical and pithy musical comments are by Nancy Faust, the best baseball stadium organist ever. Our announcer today, fitting with the sports themes, my friend Kenny Mayne. Everything else, pretty much my fault. So that's countdown for this, the 208th day until the 2024 presidential election and the 1,193rd day since Dementia J. Trump's first attempted coup against the democratically elected government of the United States. Use the 14th Amendment and the not regularly given elector objection option. Use the Insurrection Act. Use the justice system. Use the mental health system to stop him from doing it again while we still can. The next scheduled countdown is Tuesday. Bulletins as the news warrants. Till then, I'm Keith Olbermann. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and good luck. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax, Terminix can help. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast. If your home or business has pests, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.